This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Welcome back to another edition of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. Whoa, do you see what I did there? An edition of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I'm like, whoa. I know, right? This is another one of the episodes that we recorded at the Risk and Gambling Conference that UNLV hosted in Las Vegas. I'm putting two episodes out there today. This is the first one, which features the quite brilliant, and two people I didn't expect to bump into there, Dan Waugh of Regulus Partners, and Dan is worth listening to on basically any subject, and Simon Thomas, the top man at the Hippodrome Casino in London. We will kick off with Simon, follow up with Dan, and the sound quality isn't as perfect as it is when we're recording remotely. But hopefully that won't prove too much of a distraction. Enjoy the episode. John Bruford of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. The man himself is not actually here at the moment. I think he's suffering with diarrhea again. But I'm here, luckily, and I'm joined by frequent guest, although not to this podcast, to my many other podcasts, Simon Thomas of the Hippodrome Casino in London. Hello, Simon.
Hello, John.
Now, I bumped into you in many places around the world, but I was not expecting to see you here.
Yeah. Well, this is actually my third visit. I came in 2019 and 2023. For me, it's essential to understand the entire remit of the industry, good and bad. And it's also, as a trustee of GamCare for 12 years, I've sort of been on the other side of the problem gambling issue. Because at the end of the day, we're in the industry, we don't want to hurt people. And we should understand what is good, what is bad, and what techniques there are to help people that need help. But also be in a position to defend the industry when there is demonstrably bad research or agenda-driven research, where you have researchers that are stating what they are going to find from their research and then find research that will prove their hypothesis or whatever, or pushing for regulations when there is no evaluation. And we seem to be in a bit of a problem at the moment where we, across really most of the world, have a bit of an anti-gambling lobby who are well funded. The UK has now just given 20 million to problem gambling, or to gambling research, which is problem gambling research. And it is going to find problems, because that is what they're trying to do. And that will inevitably lead to more regulation and more taxation, which will inevitably lead to more people going into the unregulated, unprotected market, which ironically will cause more harm. I think the trick for all of us is to find the solution where the industry, the regulators, and the academics work together to make sure that the industry does what it does well, which is give people excitement, stimulation. When you walk through Vegas, you can see an awful lot of people having an amazing time, but also protect the minority, the few that have disordered gambling. And it is a balance.
It is. It's interesting that so many critics of the industry I know this is going to sound sweeping. Actually, I'm okay with that. So many critics of the industry don't understand the industry or are not gamblers. And I've always found it fascinating that so many people working in the industry with lived experience of their own or of the problem gambling of a loved one, those people are not the prohibitionists. They don't want gambling wiped off the map despite their own experiences, some of which were friggin' awful. They just want clear and precise regulation. And not to regulate the industry into disappearing, because they also recognize what you were saying about the black market. They don't want it to disappear. And let's face it, if any industry in any country, but if gambling is regulated into oblivion in any country, that's not a good outcome. But when people like you and I say that from within the industry, it's, oh, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? Well, I'm saying it because I believe it's true. I'm not saying it because it's an agenda I've got. I'm saying it because I've researched this and you probably haven't. And I think it's immensely frustrating, but there are also very few conversations that are as polar as the pro-anti-gambling. It's extraordinary. I mean, the only thing I can liken it to is modern politics. but it's people are either vehemently one way or vehemently another, or ignorant of both sides.
I think when you look at the debate, you've got a very few people at one end who absolutely hate gambling or making a very good business out of researching problem gambling. You've got a few people at the other end that really love gambling. And then in the middle, you've got a huge amount of people that really just don't care. They're really happy to put a fiver on the 2:30 at Kempston or whatever, and put a bit of money on the football player slot machine, play the national lottery, and they're not affected. It's part of their life. They're not going to die in a ditch to defend it, but they also don't want it stopped. And interesting what you say about people who are trying to ban gambling who don't understand it. And the lived experience question, I think it's quite offensive that it's the way that it's called gambling research and lived experience when it's problem gambling research and lived experience of problem gambling. They should be open to having debates and conversations with people who have lived experience of positive gambling. The 10 million that's gone to the University of Glasgow, they have made it very clear they didn't want any industry involvement whatsoever. So no experience from the business, the lived experience from the people that they're trying to research, which is insane, quite frankly. And having seen their agenda and some of the topics that are being researched, it would make a private eye story when they're talking about problem gambling and solving it using Lego blocks and menstrual cycle and all sorts of very weird topics to research. It's worth having a look at the agenda. No industry is allowed to be there. For me, going forward, I think conferences like this are essential because you've actually got some industry, some academic, and some regulators. We've really got a common enemy called the black market, which is cybercrime. And if we sit in our little silos and try to knock each other down, the only people that will benefit are the criminals running black market sites, and they're very good. And they are in many ways better than the regulated market because they don't pay tax, they can give better bonuses, they don't hassle the customer for information. If the customer's inconveniently on GamStop because they actually want to stop gambling, they don't have to worry about that. And the products they've got are as good as any other website. Obviously, you can use credit cards, and you can use crypto, and you can even advertise on the shirt front of Premier League when when licensed ones can't. Now, we've got to actually come together and find a balance where you've got proportional regulation, proportional taxation that allows a legitimate industry to thrive and do what it does well, albeit with proper controls and regulations to help people that need help, but not push it down the sort of the virtual Laffer curve to the point that people get displaced into unprotected, unregulated markets. And it's not acceptable for the regulator to sort of deny the black market or make it out that the industry are just using it as a bit of a cry wolf. All the research and evidence on the black market now just demonstrates the sheer size of it, and it is growing as countries like the UK are putting up tax rates and putting in more hurdles and friction into the journey.
Well, we've seen very, very well documented Sweden, Germany, Netherlands, and the Netherlands' own regulator has spoken publicly about the well, it's almost lemmings off a cliff, although I know that that's actually an untrue bit. People almost stampeding to the black market. The channelization in the Netherlands is bonkers.
Yeah.
So the numbers are insane, but there's it's actually a great example of how things work but don't work, in that in most governments, the body that sets the tax rate is not the body that regulates the industry. And there's quite a big disconnect between those two things. The body that regulates the industry, you can assume a good level of knowledge about the industry. The government setting the tax, you can assume a relatively low level. I mean, in the UK, I was reading the report of the All Party Parliamentary Group the other week, led by... I'm so rock and roll. I did my wild stuff when I was younger, in my 40s. But the, led by Ian Duncan Smith, this group's got two lords and a lady in it. I've been saying for years, like, the middle class voice on both sides of this argument has no idea of what it's like to live in poverty. It's got no idea of what it's like to struggle or to actually buy a lottery ticket and really hope that it's a winner, even a small winner. They have no idea of this. They have no concept of it. They've never lived it. And I find that really frustrating. And it's, you and I have wildly different backgrounds. We can still have a conversation, we can still exchange ideas, we can still, we come from a generation where you can disagree and still get on just fine. And we don't have to have this wildly polar thing, I mean, it's okay to mix with people that are from a different background to yourself. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, sir.
Well, it's essential to have all the voices so you can make informed decisions.
I don't think all the voices are in the conversation, though.
No, but if you live in your own echo chamber where you are given £10 million from the government and you've got a group of people who are all looking for ways to prove their hypotheses about how bad gambling is, you will find researchers that will be able to come up with research that says gambling is bad, but maybe a bit of research should be done that shows whether, as I think it's a reasonable hypothesis, if you over-regulate and over-tax, it leads to higher harm. Clearly the illegal sites are not going to offer the ability to survey all their customers, but if regulation and player protection makes any difference whatsoever, and quite a few of the measures that are out there have never actually been properly evaluated, but let's assume that they do make a difference. If you don't have them, then it is going to lead to more harm. And if the government is happy to have unregulated sites, then it should really offer the same to the industry and have an unregulated industry, a legal industry, so they can compete on fair grounds. But now clearly that's not going to happen. And we've got the politics issue. You're obviously right about Treasury being told I've got to make a number and so they will do something. The political expediency of bashing gambling is always popular. It sounds like a good vote winner. But the irony of bashing gambling and trying to increase a tax can, like very much like Holland is a perfect example, reduce the amount of tax and increase the amount of harm, which isn't the right outcome. And if people can't get together and actually debate that openly, then we're a lesser place.
Yeah, that's very fair. And impossible to disagree with that. I need to have a look at the Glasgow document. I really, although it might just make me cry.
Probably make you laugh, to be honest. A bit of levity.
We've seen so many times over the years people saying the gambling industry should pay for treatment, research, blah, blah, blah. And, like, I don't really have an issue with that. And then, in fact, I have seen this with my own eyes. I saw somebody tweet, the gambling industry should pay for, you know, research, treatment, etc. And the same person, a week later, said the gambling industry shouldn't be anywhere near funding research, etc. And I'm just like, you really should make your mind up.
Well, no, they'd like the gambling industry to fund their research, but they don't want the industry to have any involvement.
Well, the thing is, the industry has the data. And the data is really, really important.
Yeah,
and that's why the work
people
of...
People just say the industry should be forced to give the data.
But that's why the work of people like Dr. Auer is really important, because the data he presented today that we were both looking at, you know, he's got access to superb data from multiple countries to be able to compare, and he's got no agenda in doing that. He's not trying to prove gambling is good or bad. He's just, this is the data. This is what we learned.
Actually, his presentation was interesting, that effectively the more regulation and control you put on the industry, the lower the spend, which is fairly logical. But then extrapolating that the other way, take away control, the spend will go up, which is the unregulated black market.
Yeah. It's, I mean, having Germany in his data set was like, it's obviously it's super restrictive. You know, you've got your €1 bet limit, you've got your monthly spend limit, I think. But the fascinating thing about Germany is that they've got that centralized data. So that monthly limit is across all operators. So while Germany is wildly restrictive in some ways, there are some things that I think that other jurisdictions can take from that, in terms of how cross-operator data can be used in terms of problem gambling behaviours. But of course, getting people to agree these things is a freaking nightmare. Unless the government wades in and says, this is the way it's going to be, which is of course what they've done in Germany. Speak of the devil.
I'm not that bad.
Do you want to bring a chair around?
Yes.
We're just talking. Simon's just been talking about the.
Hi, Simon. So nice to meet you.
Simon's just been talking about the. Did you read about this? The £10 million grant that's gone to Glasgow University, I think, for researching problem gambling in the UK.
Well, it's supposed to be gambling research, but it will be. Problem gambling, and the other conference that's going on at the moment gives a flavour of the sort of topics that will be researched in a complete vacuum with no industry involvement or ability to try to put some balance on any conversation. I'll send you a copy of the agenda for the conference. It is quite extraordinary. Even to an untrained eye, you'd think, oh my God, this is some pretty weird stuff.
Like I said before, in order to understand players, you have to work with real world data. You have to work with industry to understand, you know, the psychology of gambling. What you said, you know, in my presentation about, okay, what are positive aspects about it? You know, people who enjoy the activity, you know, how can we make sure that the majority enjoy it? How can we make sure to understand it? So focusing really on, you know, the typical player, the average player, the recreational player. That's a thing that's really neglected in gambling research because it most predominantly focuses on problem gambling, right?
Yep. The evidence, if you take the British surveys, fairly clearly shows there's a correlation between good mental health and gambling, and equally at the other end, bad mental health and problem gambling. People who gamble actually have above average mental health. Now, correlation and causation obviously are quite hard to unpick, but it's not unreasonable to think that people who go out and socialise and have the stimulation and enjoyment of gambling have a good time.
Sure.
And equally the people who can't control their gambling have a bad time.
Sure. And I mean, it's partly your job, you know, to create an environment that most people can enjoy and not run into issues.
Yeah. You know, well, if you take the Hippodrome, I've got 30,000 customers a week. A third don't gamble. They actually like going into a casino because it's safe. It's got a big wall of security around it because we don't want drunk people in there. We don't want people who are looking to misbehave or whatever. We want to create a safe environment. So it's actually a great place to go, even if you don't gamble. But it's got walls, and it's got food on offer, and it's got alcohol on offer. And when customers come for a fun evening out, they don't want to be poisoned, they don't want to be made drunk, they don't want the part of the building to fall on them, and they also don't want to spend more money than they can afford gambling, because that, by definition, is not fun. But I don't lead with my food by saying safer food and you can eat safely. I say I've got a really good steak. It's fantastic. Best food in the place. And at the same time, we make sure that a food standard, which has just been checked recently, and we're still 5-star, is good, because I don't want to poison people. And my building maintenance is fabulous, because I don't want people to be hurt by something falling on them, and same with the bars. And in the same way, gambling should be treated exactly the same way. Some people can get into difficulties. From a business point of view, they're not actually good customers. And we've done a bad job if we have these people in there, because they're spending money they can't afford, it's unsustainable, and they're having harm caused to them. And so we have to protect them in the same way we protect people from all the other possibilities of harm in the building. But at the same time, create environments where people can do what they want to do with their money and have a really enjoyable experience. When you walk around the casinos here, it's so evident. There's an awful lot of people that are having a brilliant time. And they've saved up, they've come out here, they are just having a complete blast. And equally, when you walk through the streets, you can see some people begging on the streets, and who knows why and how they've got into that situation.
I do think that a lot of the pushback on gambling, both in the US and the UK, and probably many other countries, is related to the proliferation of advertising, which, you know, even as somebody within the industry, it is wildly excessive. Did you see that there was a Bristol University study on, they looked at one Premier League match, In the first half, there were something like 15,000 views of something gambling related. So it's advertising hoardings, adverts, shirt sponsors, etc. 15,000 in 45 minutes. That's extraordinary and bonkers, and some of those aren't even UK-facing brands. They're, of course, trying to appeal to Asian customers. I think a lot of the pushback is unrelated to gambling itself. It's related to fucking hell, another advert.
I agree with you in principle, but I'd actually put a slightly different sort of viewpoint on that. When I watch football, I don't notice all that. I'm watching the game. So if you're going out to try to see how many times you can see something on the hoardings, you're not actually watching the football. That's not a natural experience. So I don't even notice it. What I do notice, and it really, really irritates me, is television adverts for gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And when you actually think about how people consume TV these days, generally it's recorded, or it's a box set, it's Netflix, whatever. And if, God forbid, there's any adverts, you can just scan through them. Mm-hmm. The only time you actually have to watch adverts is a live event, which generally is around sporting. And obviously they've got some whistle-to-whistle bands type things, but you still, in America, I was talking to some chaps from the AGA, and they said, but we don't understand the backlash on advertising. Gambling advertising is only 2 or 3% of total advertising. I said, yes, but have a look when it's consumed. And it's always around a live sporting event. Yeah. So perhaps for the people that are watching television, it might be 50% of the adverts might be gambling.
Mm.
Yeah, you're right. See. Yesterday, the Las Vegas Knights, the ice hockey team, played Colorado.
Yep.
I watched it, 1-0, right? 2-1. 2-1, really?
2-1, yeah. They've won the conference or whatever they call it.
Yeah, so I watched it on TV in the bar, and you're right, it was every break, after every break you had with the advertising.
But that's, I totally get the pushback.
And then the other side of that, obviously online, if you've said, I like gambling, and the algorithm starts kicking in, you're going to get hammered.
I was talking to Michael the other week, because I was writing an article for IGB. And it was being critical of the all-party parliamentary group that we were talking about earlier. And Michael he sent me a very simple message. Because the increase in gambling advertising spend since 2010, I mean, it's gone, it's like up like a fucking rocket.
In America or?
In the UK. But problem gambling prevalence hasn't moved at all. The only shift in that was when they changed the methodology of how it was measured. So it suggests that we're not very good at advertising, for one thing. Because you'd think if there are all these people out there just waiting to get addicted, then we should have at least captured some of them. Obviously, I'm being facile there, but the point stands, though, that the problem gambling prevalence hasn't risen, and yet we're spending something like four times more on advertising now.
And we've also brought in a lot of regulations that are supposed to control problem gambling. You could not unreasonably say that the regulations actually don't make much difference and the advertising actually doesn't make much difference. There's a natural level of people who have whatever addictive gene that will get into trouble on alcohol, food, gambling or whatever. And it's pretty consistent across the world. This is obviously the switch to the GSGB in the UK is a tad problematic. If their figures were wonderful, were correct, I got the like would be good, because they, for example, according to GSGB in the last month, 1 million people have played live casino games in a casino, and sorry, 2 million, but we've actually got hard data. And it's around 1/3 of 1 million. So their figures are out by
quite a lot.
Yeah, because these figures are based on self-reported information, you know.
Yeah, self-reporting, but also, yeah, well, self-reporting, and also the, obviously the survey lands in the family, and it's a gambling survey. Well, Dad, you'd like gambling. You're the one who fills it in. So it's obviously there's a quite a lot of bias in there. But when you've actually got hard data that says these figures are not right, the Gambling Commission is so invested in their survey that they're proving quite hard to get them to admit that there might be a problem with it.
Mm.
And going back to your research earlier, we all just want good research. We want good, unbiased research that allows the regulator, the taxman, the industry, the player, all to have the right environment. And there is obviously no player as such in our area. There are some people, entire spectrum of people, and right at the bottom end, there are people that, come what may, are going to get into trouble. And the industry has to be grown up and help them and recognize it. But we don't need to have people with bad research and bad regulation, damaging the life of people who want to have fun, and also having resources mistargeted to people that don't have a problem, don't need help, because that's not very good.
Interesting point about surveys, and something that I think is underappreciated in the world. Surveys are incredibly difficult to do well. I mean, staggeringly difficult to do well. I see very few good surveys. I see very few surveys where the questions are phrased in the right way, where because the question needs to be phrased with no ambiguity, because you're looking for an absolute answer. Yeah,
which is very hard.
It is. They're extraordinarily difficult to do, and very often organizations that are doing surveys, I mean, there are obviously companies that their whole job is surveys, and they generally do know what they're doing.
I mean, good example in gambling is game types, right? So you have a survey and you ask, okay, what types of games did you play last 12 months? And then one category would be lottery. What's it mean, right? It's very big difference between lottery draw, like you buy a weekly ticket to the Euro jackpot or whatever it is, and buying scratch cards. Or some lotteries even have like digital instant games, they call them, which are very much like slot machines, you know?
Yeah.
Makes a huge difference.
Instant gratification. And absolutely, I mean, we all know how surveys work. You decide what you want to get, and then you construct your survey to try to give you the answer you want.
But if you take that approach, you're leaving yourself wide open to criticism.
Well, absolutely.
I've seen that, but the worst examples...
Some of the research, the bad research that's going on, is almost criminal, because they've decided what they want to achieve, and then they're trying to find a way of justifying.
We do that too, though, from this side of the fence. The worst survey I've seen in decades was by the American Gaming Association. It was fucking shocking. And your survey is only as good as the people that are filling it out, fundamentally. It's only as good as that group. So who is that group? That's why the demographic information being available is very important, because that tells us how good your information is.
Yeah.
And they did a survey, and I can't remember what they were looking for. And I looked up the demographic information, and it just said, people of voting age in the United States. I'm like, great.
Good point.
Do you remember that adage that you can explain something to people, you can't understand it for them? And that's clearly a problem. It's exactly as you say, when you get a question, people understand it different ways.
For me, the most difficult is really to rely on spending information from surveys. Because if I ask you, okay, so let's say the survey asks, how much did you spend gambling the last 12 months? How should a person interpret that question? Does this mean how much money I, you know, in the land-based, for example, how much money did I sort of, you know, slip into the machine? How much money did I, at the end of the day, walk away with? right? So bet minus winning, and you know, taking into account the winnings. It's completely unclear. And in the online, I mean, it works a bit different. You have to deposit, you have to withdraw, and you also have the betting, and you have the winning.
Yeah.
So it's completely unclear, you know, what it actually means at the end of the day. And let's say, you know, I go to the hippodrome, whatever, you know, twice a week, I play the slot, then I can generate an overall revenue bet stake of hundreds of thousands. But at the end of the day, okay, I spend 5% of this because of the RTP. I mean, nobody, and I'm very confident, if you asked 100 customers of yours there and you compared that statement with the actual spend, I'm very confident they will be very wrong.
Yeah, well, we do that in practice when people have a go at us, and one person had a go at us, blamed us for the fact that they were spending money they couldn't afford, and could we give it them back? We actually checked their records and they were in a positive situation.
So yeah.
Which didn't really fit with their narrative. But any of those questions, you ask me how much I'd spent on Amazon in the last year or alcohol, or food, I wouldn't have a clue.
Hopefully not so much.
Yes. Oh, no, I like Amazon.
You like Amazon?
I like the simplicity of...
Hey, maybe they're going to sponsor us.
Now you're talking. Sponsorships are available of the podcast. Contact us for details.
Jeff Bezos will be on the phone immediately, I'm sure.
Yeah, he's a big fan.
It's crazy. Like, you know, I drove here from Vegas and... From LA to Vegas.
You're in Vegas.
And I mean, every second truck was a Prime truck. Really, lots of Prime trucks. Not sure what's inside, but...
I don't know. Could be anything.
Lots of Chinese stuff we don't need, but whatever.
Simon Thomas, thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure was mine.
Thank you, Simon.
Nice to see you both.
And now it's over to Dan Waugh of Regulus Partners. So, myself and Dr. Auer are still here in Las Vegas. We're not having any fun at all. It's all very serious and work-related. Isn't that right, Dr. Auer?
Absolutely. I saw you napping a lot.
No, that was just in your presentation. I was wide awake in all of the others, believe me. We're joined by a very special guest, a man whose name I knew before I met him. I'd say this is the worst intro I've ever done in my life, I think. But joined by Dan Waugh of Regulus Partners. Did I get that right, Dan?
That's correct, yes.
Thank fuck. Whew. That's the difficult part. So you did a presentation this morning. So we're on day two of the conference. What was your presentation? What was the nuts and bolts?
My presentation was pretty basic, really. There's a lot of people presenting very complex, sophisticated research with lots of complicated maths in it. But mine was a very basic presentation about testing the reliability of prevalence surveys. And the focus really is the gambling survey for Great Britain, which was launched about 3 years ago and has replaced the health survey as the main source of official statistics on both gambling participation and problem gambling. And one of the reason why it's significant is that it produces much higher reported levels of gambling participation and problem gambling than health surveys have done. So health surveys have typically reported rates of problem gambling at about between 0.3 and 0.7% of the adult population. The GSGB, as it's known, is now producing estimates at 2.5% to 2.7%. So these are way out of kilter with what we've seen before. And this matters because it's one of the main sources of data that drives regulatory policy. And I think the system of the law we have, the spirit of the law we have for gambling in Britain and the system of regulation is really built around the idea that the vast majority of people can gamble with reasonable levels of control and can gain enjoyment and benefits from doing it. But we also know that some people can experience severe harm. And so there's a balancing act there that's designed to allow majority to pursue their get their kicks as they will, and but also to make sure there's protections in place for others. Now, I think what happens if you start to, if your assumption is that the rates of harm are much higher than previously thought, it may then change the way that regulation is approached, so that the freedom of the adult to enjoy their, to seek their enjoyment through gambling is downgraded, and protection becomes the only thing that matters. So because the GSGB estimates of participation and problem gambling prevalence is so much higher than health statistics indicate, it seemed to me a couple of years ago that this should be, we should try to understand what's driving this. We should try to understand whether it's reliable. And what I've been able to do is obtain hard data on actual gambling participation. So these are the number of visits that are reported by casino operators to land-based casinos. Flutter provided me with information about the number of unique customers they have in any four-week period, and the Football Pools Limited, which is a monopoly provider of the pools in Britain, did the same. So then I was able to take a look at the survey estimates of participation in these three activities and compare it with hard data on what, you know, how many people are actually doing this rather than the survey estimate.
And in the land-based, you said you have visitation statistics.
Yes.
But those are not unique, are they? Or
so they're not unique. So, but that doesn't matter for the purpose of this study, because the GSGB, as well as providing, as well as asking, have you done this? Have you played table games in a casino? It also says, how frequently have you done this in the past?
All right.
So from that, we can derive an estimate of the number of visits, which we can then compare with the reported number of visits that people who are actually visiting casinos in Britain. And the interesting thing about the casino visit data is that the Gambling Commission used to collect this. The Gambling Commission used to publish this. So, you know, the Gambling Commission has had this data, and it could have checked. It could have done the checks that I've done.
In the British Gambling Prevalence Survey. That was before, right? Because I think the first paper mentioning these data is from 2010.
So the BGPS ran for three editions. The first one was 1999. It was actually an industry initiative. So the industry sort of decided we need this. But then from 2007 and 2010, we had subsequent editions. And that was owned by the Gambling Commission. But it was fundamentally the same survey. And in 2012, the British Gambling Prevalence Survey gets canned. And instead, they put gambling questions into the National Health Service health surveys. So on a periodic basis. So we had it 2012, 2015, 2016, 2018, 2021 and 2024. We've had gambling questions in this health survey series.
And now this new survey, what's it called?
The Gambling Survey for Great Britain.
That's completely not new. Like, when was that launched?
Yeah, it was went into field in 2023. Well, I say field, it's an online survey.
But yeah.
Data was collected from in 2023. The 2024 report was published last year. The 2023 report was published last year. The 2024 report.
What was still also when they changed the problem gambling questions, like the PGSI?
So the PGSI,
yep.
They used the PGSI.
Yep.
The health survey traditionally used the DSM for in addition to the PGSI.
But they also changed like from the long to the short version or something like that,
because no.
In 23 the number doubled, but it was simply due to a different methodology of asking.
No, so the health survey had the full 9-item PGSI, and so does the Gambling Survey for Great Britain. There was another prevalence survey which the Gambling Commission used to run called the Quarterly Telephone Survey.
Yeah.
So that was a telephone survey, and that used the 3-item short form PGSI. And that was really used sort of to assess trend data. It wasn't designed to capture population preference, because they recognized it wasn't as robust as an in-person survey.
So what did you find then? Did you find that the Gambling Commission overestimates participation, underestimates it?
So what we found systemically was substantial overstatement. So with casinos, I think it was up to you know, we're looking at 2 years worth of data here, so we've got different comparisons, but we're looking at up to 628% overstatement for...
Sorry, it makes me laugh every time you say
about who, how many visited the casino?
Yes.
Or
yeah, overstatement of the number of visits to casinos.
Okay, so why do you think that's the case? Because people don't really can tell what a casino is, so they basically did whatever, went in another place and said it was a casino. Or
well, it's difficult because
maybe they're confusing it with a fish and chip shop.
Yeah, but it's that, you know, I think that's been that doesn't really hold in this case, because the way the questionnaire is structured in the GSGB is they're asked, have you played casino games in person at a casino, or have you played casino games on a machine or a terminal in a casino or other venue? So if you've played in another venue, you're not going to say you've played in person in a casino. So the only real way that you can explain the discrepancy is either the survey is wrong, either you've got significant skew in the sample that means it's not a representative of the population, or you have this vast unlicensed market, not only for land-based casinos, but also for exchange betting and the football pools that we never knew existed. And the beautiful thing about the football pools example is because the football pools is a monopoly, has been since 2007, all the Littlewoods and all that came together. So, you know, you're left with the situation of, well, the football pool says it's got about, in a four-week period, it's got something like 108,000 customers, uniques, in a four-week period. The GSGB says they've got 880,000. So, you know...
But the football pool, I mean, you got hold of hard data from the football pool.
Yes.
So this objective, actual, this real data.
This is real
there
data.
There isn't anything else called the football pool.
Can I just ask a stupid question here, right? The people that ran this survey, did they think about going to the football pools and asking...
Well, we first brought this to the Gambling Commission's attention in August 2022, so it's before it's even been launched, because they did some pilot surveys. And so what we saw the same thing there, we saw massive overestimation of participation. So we went to the Gambling Commission, or I went to the Gambling Commission in August 2022 and pointed this out and said, you really should, before you push on, you've got the data. You know, you get an awful lot of this data from regulatory returns that your licensees provide to you. Go and have a look at it. And don't take my word for it. Go and have a look at the data yourselves and test it against the survey data and see if they match up. And the Gambling Commission elected not to do that. So now we're in a situation where the survey's been published. It's been published for 2 years. It's already, I would say, it's having an impact on how... the market is regulated, it's having an impact on political sentiment towards the market, and it's clearly, certainly with respect to casinos, betting exchange and football pools, is wrong. And the problem is that the Gambling Commission's now sort of got sunk cost here. They've spent an awful lot of money
of course,
and they've put their reputation behind
it. It's hard to backpedal, right?
Very hard.
But what it is, I mean, did they ever release any statements? I mean, they must have, maybe, you know, if somebody from Gambling Commission sat here, they said, oh my God, Dan, you have no idea what you're doing. Those data are completely correct. You are completely wrong. I mean, I don't know, you know, maybe you're making all of this up, Dan.
Well, except I think, you know, they can go and get the data themselves. I think, you know, it's healthy to be skeptical. They can go to the football pools limited, they can go to Flutter. I say the casino data, they used to publish themselves. It's quite hard for them to sort of...
So are you saying that suddenly, I mean, after, you know, they introduced a new survey, the casino participation skyrocketed compared to what they published before? Or would you... So if we went into the published reports, the past published reports, would we see like bam, you know, like a discrete change also based on what they publish?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting.
You see big differences between the...
But how do they argue that? I mean, like...
Well, I think what the Commission has tried to do is to claim that because the GSGB is an online... Well, two-thirds of people respond online, one-third by postal response. Their sort of claim has been,
That this is now more accurate because
there's less social desirability bias affecting it. So they're saying that if you're interviewed in person, even though in the health survey, yes, you're interviewed in person, but the PGSI questions and the gambling questions are given to you in a self-completion booklet. So nobody's looking at your answers. Yeah, okay. So, but the Gambling Commission has tried to claim that they think that the health statistics have been underreporting gambling, participation and problem gambling, because of the presence of the the interesting thing, though, is that, well, one, that's not what the data says. The hard data shows that, actually the health survey has been pretty accurate on participation. But also, the more worrying thing is, if you believe, as the Gambling Commission suggested, that the health survey has underreported problem gambling, for example, because of desirability bias, then that means it must be underreporting all mental health conditions, which means that for the last 35 years, the National Health Service hasn't had a clue about the prevalence of mental health disorders.
So there must be much more depression, anxiety.
So one thing that's quite interesting, actually, the health survey is going to transition online over the course of the next few years. It's going to take place in a phased approach. So it'll be in-person plus online, and then gradually in-person will drop away, which is the way to do it, I think, because then you get to understand, well, how does data collection affect the results? So we'll be able to see the effect of this. When the health survey moves online, will we see increases in reported rates of all mental health disorders? I don't know. I think the big issue with the gambling survey for Great Britain is that it's advertised as a gambling survey. So you get, this brings into play what's known as topic salience bias. So if you run a survey about the cheese in Shropshire, for example, you will get, which I know is one of John's passions in life, you will get people with a deep interest in eating cheese from Shropshire more likely to take part in that survey, right? So if you advertise it as a gambling survey, you will get more, not only more gamblers, but you'll get more highly engaged gamblers. And this is, Rob Williams and Rachel Volberg did a study on this in 2009 and demonstrated it. Sally Gainsbury from Sydney University has done a similar study last year. So, and you do see it, you know, if it's a gambling survey, people who gamble are far more likely to take part, particularly if they're more highly engaged gamblers. And that's where you're likely to see, okay, so now we understand why the problem gambling rate is likely to be so much higher, because this is not a representative sample of the population. These are very highly engaged participants.
One of the things we were just talking to Simon Thomas about was the science of doing a good survey, because I genuinely believe it's an extremely difficult thing to do. It's extremely difficult to get the language right. But a survey is only as good as the demographic that it's gone to, as the group and how the group is selected has gone to. And I've seen some awful examples in recent years, not least from the American Gaming Association. But part of me is kind of sympathetic towards people who are trying to base anything on a survey. But on the other hand, when there are people such as yourself who are saying, hang on a sec, lads, let's stop and have a think about this. It sounds to me from what you're saying that you've been saying the right things to the right people and have got nowhere.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we've got nowhere at all. I mean, last year the Office for Statistics Regulation published a review of the gambling survey for Great Britain and were reasonably critical of what the Gambling Commission had done, particularly in relation to not being clear about the risks, that the survey was unreliable, and also about not being overly receptive to feedback. So we have seen, there is some oversight here from the statistics regulator, providing oversight on the gambling regulator. And the OSR is due to sort of review this again in the coming months. So I think we've been getting generally nowhere with the Gambling Commission. And I think it's because they've invested not only money, but their reputation behind this. And so, as Michael pointed out, it's quite hard for them to reverse out of here. But the statistics regulator is looking at this. The DCMS has actually been far more cautious on this than the Gambling Commission. The DCMS says we have to look at a wide range of data.
That's such a strange sentence. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
But I think the thing is, the data is so clear, And every time, you know, the GSGB reports quarterly in terms of participation, and every time it does that, we can look at the relevant data from the industry. So we can keep showing, okay, you know, your latest estimates are out by this, your latest estimates are out by this. And eventually, I think, the Gambling Commission really, if it values its credibility, which may be an open question, but if it values its credibility, if it wants people to trust it, then I think it's got to act on this. And it's got to say, well, look, there are some doubts around this data. I think the other thing I would say is that, you know, when the Gambling Commission first sort of launched this, they said, this is, we're getting rid of the health survey, we're getting rid of the quarterly telephone survey, this is going to be one version of the truth. And I think that that's a bit misguided. You know, we're dealing with quite, particularly when you get into gambling sort, you're dealing with quite complex stuff here. To think that there's one thing that will show you the answer is, I think, a bit naive. And probably what they ought to be aiming to do is to try and build a composite picture. The GSGB is not necessarily useless. It, you know, it provides some insights in certain regards, but then operator data can provide insights. The health data can provide insights. Maybe open banking data can provide insights. So there's lots of sources of data here. And I think we've all got to get a bit better at, rather than trying to sort of prove a point or claim a statistic, say, actually, you know, this is complex. Let's look at it from different angles. And let's, you know, let's use that to sort of create a more nuanced picture of what's going on. But that's not where the Commission is at the moment. I think that is unfortunate.
Yeah. Obviously, Andrew Rhodes has left the Gambling Commission. But I know that as a body, they come under fire a lot, some of which is more than fair. But I do want to say the difference between the Commission when he got there and the Commission now is massive. Because they wouldn't answer, and believe me, I tried, they wouldn't even reply to my fucking emails before. And we've had him on the podcast. You know, it's like, it's night and day. There's much more transparency and willingness to speak to all the stakeholders. But unfortunately, the Gambling Commission is the commission for the easiest industry in any country to demonize. Mm. And so they're damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't.
Yeah, and look, I was a personal license holder once upon a time. I've done work for the Gambling Commission. Theirs is not an easy job. Mm. I think where they went wrong, you know, I think you look back on the era when Jenny Williams was running it, that looks like, you know, that's the golden era of the Gambling Commission. And I think it's because when Jenny was running it, and with Philip Graff as chair, you know, they were focused on the job.
Yeah.
You know, the mandatory licensing conditions in the Gambling Act, that was their point of reference. That's what they wanted. And I think probably sort of starting in the Neil MacArthur era, the Gambling Commission sort of lost that clear focus. And it started, you know, you start to hear a lot about, you know, we must take a public health approach without really saying what a public health approach involves. And you know, the thing I think we have to understand about the Gambling Commission, whether it's Neil or Andrew or whatever, but in the last 5 years, the Gambling Commission has funneled millions of pounds into activism through organisations like Gambling with Lives or the Association of Directors of Public Health. They have suppressed research that's not been convenient. A classic example being the affordability survey, where, you know, 88% of bettors said we don't want this, and they buried the survey. It took two FOIs to get it out. They have misrepresented research. They have on their website, still there today, it's been up for 2 years, they've got gambling speech codes, which say what you are and aren't allowed to say. You're not allowed to say that gambling is an enjoyable pastime, for example. You're not allowed to say that gambling can be fun. This is on the Gambling Commission's website. So I think the problem is that they have got themselves involved in lots of areas where they should be nowhere near. They shouldn't be funding activism. They should. I mean, there's been some atrocious research has been funded by the Gambling Commission. In 2023, the National Institute of Economic and Social Research was funded by the Gambling Commission to produce a report to say there was 1.4 billion of fiscal costs every year in Britain due to problem gambling. Now, first of all, what value of that is what is the value of that finding to the Gambling Commission? How does that reduce harm? But secondly, you then look at the survey. I mean, they invented statistics. I mean, they used a survey called the Wealth and Assets Survey to generate 60% of the estimate. Now, the Wealth and Assets Survey has no information whatsoever about problem gambling. So what the researchers did was they said, let's look at what data is there. And they said, if you're out of work due to ill health and you have won more than £500 in the last 2 years from gambling, we're going to call you an at-risk gambler. They said, even if you've never gambled, you can be a problem gambler. So this is the absolute junk science that the Gambling Commission has funded. And that piece of research was used to lobby for the tax changes we saw last year. So this is my job. I think the Gambling Commission has got a tough job, always will do, right? But it makes that job so much harder. And the bizarre thing is, even though it's thrown money at some of these organisations I mentioned, it still gets stick off them. You know, these organisations are ruder about the Gambling Commission than I ever am. So, you know, I'm hoping with the new CEO, it'd be great to just find a way back to, look, this is our job, stick to your knitting, this is your job, uphold the licensing conditions, don't try and engineer change in the law yourselves by funding activists to lobby you. I mean, that's crazy.
I'm waiting for them to call, but they haven't yet, so it's disappointing, but I was hoping to be in position by now.
What do you think? I mean, you mentioned before public health approach, gambling harm. What do you think of that trend compared to real, you know, problem gambling disorder?
So I think it depends what you mean by it. I mean, I think a public health approach to gambling is a term that's bandied around, but, you know, it was, I think the first paper on a public health approach to gambling was in 1999 by David Corn and Howard Schaefer. And Howard Schaefer was part of the, you know, one of the authors of the Reno model, which is meant to be, you know, if you believe what these people say, it's meant to be in opposition to public health.
Yeah.
But so we've always had public health as part of the approach to gambling regulation in Great Britain. That is why you have to be 18 to gamble. That is that's an example of a population-wide measure.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you have stake and prize limits on slot machines. So we have lots of elements of a public health approach, but I think what's happened in recent years is you've almost got this radicalized strain of public health, which is now saying gambling is like tobacco, or the other one they use is asbestos. So gambling is asbestos or tobacco. The whole population must be protected from this thing. It's an activity with no redeeming features. There's no benefits from gambling. This is the mantra, and it's inherently harmful. So I think we saw people don't believe me when I say this, but it's a published paper. In 2022, our public health department in Britain, which is the Office for Health Improvement and Disparities, published a Delphi study on harm prevention measures. And these included annual tax increases above the rate of inflation, included a limit on the number of people allowed on a website at any one time. It included a ban on the sale of beer, wine and spirits at casinos, bingo clubs and racecourses. It demanded a complete ban on all advertising and marketing. But my favourite one was it said, well, we must have plain packaging for all gambling products. And you scratched your head and you thought, well, I know that's a tobacco term, but how does that manifest in gambling? So you go to the technical report and it says, no colours, logos or images on any gambling products.
So a slot machine with symbols.
Well, think about a deck of cards in a casino.
Yeah.
No Queen of Hearts anymore.
Pretty cool.
No Ace of Spades.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
So this is why I think.
I mean, maybe we should launch such a casino.
Yeah. So it sort of feels a bit Starnet.
We call it no fun at all.
It feels a bit like if Stalin launched a casino.
Yeah.
You know that it would.
Like a communist approach.
Yeah. So I think this is it. Public health has a lot to offer as a discipline. We've always had public health elements in our approach to gambling regulation, but I think what is now referred to as a public health approach to gambling is really just copying the tobacco
plan. A complete ban. Yeah, I mean, like the other day, I read an Australian report, like which came out recently, about gambling, problem gambling participation. And I'm reading this, thinking, okay, wow. I mean, this is a really high rate, you know, of problem gambling. And then I read the small print. I mean, after I found it, took me some time to find it. And they specified gambling harm as PGSI greater than 1.
Right.
You know, so to pitch your size 9 questions. And if you answer any of these questions with, you respond to any of these questions with something other than never, then you are a problem gambler. I mean, that's nuts, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
you occasionally try to win back money you've lost.
I mean, we know that the PGSI overestimates problem gambling in the first place.
Yeah.
And then to reduce the score to nothing means, I mean, it's basically almost, I mean,
yeah, we
don't
saw this.
Even have to gamble, you know, in order to be gambler.
Everyone who is here at this conference will endorse, probably get at least a 3 on the PGSI, which is moderate risk, because there's a question about preoccupation. Do you think about gambling? Yeah. Everyone here at this conference spends their whole working lives and most of their personal lives thinking about gambling. So, I mean, we saw a similar thing in Britain some years ago where, you know, under the PGSI, you have low risk, moderate risk, and problem gamblers,
yeah.
the classifications. We just saw this subtle sleight of hand where low risk got changed to low level of harm. Moderate level of harm. Well, that's not what it shows. It's a low probability of experiencing.
Yeah, and it doesn't help, you know, because if you overestimate, you know, if you water out your definitions, everything becomes blurry. And how do you then actually introduce harm minimization measures? I mean, you can't.
Yeah, well, it can lead to misallocation of resources because you're spending money on vast advertising campaigns rather than on people who really need help. The other thing that we see in, you know, we see it in the short gambling harm screen, for example. So, what, you know, there are some genuine harms in there, but one of the harms in the short gambling harm screen is, have you spent less money on going to the movies or the pub or other form of entertainment as a result of your gambling? Well, that's not a harm, that's a choice.
It's a choice, yeah.
You know, if you don't go to the movies, is that, are we really saying that if I decided to go to the casino and therefore
no, you would, you would ask, do you feel bad about, you know, not spending or spending less money on other things because of your gambling?
Yeah.
That would be kind of, you know.
Yes, that would
you
be
know,
closer.
Because closer, because kind of you sort of you can't help it, you know. I overspent, I didn't want it, and now I feel bad because I can't go to the movies.
I had less money for cocaine.
Beep.
Because I gambled it all away.
We'll cut that comment away, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use AI to make it sound like you said it.
Exactly. You can't, you know, because I'm so unique, even AI can't.
Yes, that's right. Nobody can simulate me. Get to the chopper. Dan, I know you've got places to be and that you're an important and busy person. Thank you so much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mike.